CataractCoach.com podcast series, episode number 180 with Dr. Guillermo Rocha, leading an academic team at McGill University into the future of ophthalmology.
Welcome back to our Cataract Coach podcast. Today, I've got a very special guest. That's professor and chairman, Dr. Guillermo Rocha from now Montreal at McGill. Guillermo, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much, Uday. It's great to see you. And it was great to have you here just a few weeks ago, lecturing us in the clinical day.
Yeah, you had an amazing program there. I really enjoyed spending time there. But you were very smart. You hosted me to come to Montreal in the nicer summer weather.
Exactly. That's right.
Now, I've known you guys probably 20 years back when you were very involved with the Canadian Ophthalmology Society, the COS.
That's right.
Many years. Tell us about your involvement there. And then you were, I think you were in Winnipeg, right? In Manitoba for a long time.
Manitoba for a while, yeah, almost basically 25 years in Brandon, Manitoba, in the prairies, and also working in other cities, including Winnipeg as well.
Wow. Give us a little bit about your background. You have such a fascinating background.
Yes, thank you. Thanks, Uday, and thank you for having me here on the podcast. I think many of our residents here follow you and follow the podcast as well. And so, yeah, I always think when people ask me about how I got to this particular position, it's really sometimes you can plan certain things. I think you can plan long-term goals and things in principle. But my life has taken several turns. I started in Mexico City. I was born there. I did medical school there in Mexico City and a year of training at one of the biggest hospitals in ophthalmology down there in Mexico at the APEC. Then I was offered a position to come to McGill, and so I did a year of ocular immunology and inflammation, completed my residency, and then went to Tampa, Florida with Jim Rousey and got some training in cornea and external diseases. And he happened to be one of the sites for refractive surgery for one of the up-and-coming lasers of the time. And so I also got a little bit exposure of that. Went back to Mexico for about 2 years, and we wanted to come back to Canada. And the way that happened was to sort of get a position in Manitoba. They were looking for an ophthalmologist, and we sort of, my wife and I made the decision. We had two young girls at the time, and we said, let's just get back to Canada. And it was a wonderful community, wonderful time there that allowed me to develop a lot of things and create a lot of connections as well. And about 3 years ago, I was recruited for the chair position here at McGill. And again, it's a different chapter in our lives and a great, great chapter, to say the least. And so we're enjoying our time here quite a bit.
Well, that's amazing. Yeah, you're amazing in many ways. When I saw you there in Montreal, but your French is basically fluent, perfect. You had to learn French, obviously, to work in Montreal.
I had to learn French, and I did. And then you're required to take a French test as well. So I passed that as soon as I got here. I would say I have good working knowledge of French, enough to sort of communicate with patients, explain risks, benefits. I use a lot of handouts that are translated in proper French, but I think I can relate well to patients, but socially and in fluid conversations, I find it harder. I have to be honest. So I'm okay with English and Spanish, but with French, obviously it's a little bit more difficult. But you know, it's one of the attractions, I think, of Montreal and Quebec as a whole. It really brings a lot of the culture and a lot of variety and it's just, you know, there's this joie de vivre here in Quebec in general that makes it a very pleasant place to live.
Yeah, I think for me, the only challenge would be, I mean, I've been in Mexico City where it was nice 37 degrees Celsius. And I've been in Manitoba where it's minus 37 degrees Celsius in the winter. Yeah. That's quite the swing.
It's quite the swing. And you never know why. You make certain decisions, there are opportunities and there are circumstances, both political, economic, or just things you cannot control of the direction a country goes in. And you have to sort of find what's best for your family. And we're very grateful for the opportunities as a family that we have had in Canada. And personally and professionally, I think a lot of the things, the experiences, the people I have met and the projects I've been involved with would not have been possible if I had just said, you know, let's just stay with what I know and let's give it time instead of sort of taking the jump and taking a risk. And now looking back almost 35 years, I'm happy that personally, professionally, I took those risks. And also as a family, we've been exposed to so many wonderful people. And we have friends now in different countries, in different places, in different cities that have become really true friends. You know, when you leave your country, a lot of the people that you relate to are, if they're in a similar situation, they kind of become your family. So you develop very strong ties that allow you to sort of have a good quality of life.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, McGill's quite a storied place, famous place. I was very surprised to learn that you just had your 150th anniversary of the ophthalmology department. Wow.
Yeah, yeah, that's correct. And so, you know, it was an ophthalmologist, and just before our COS meeting, we had the 150th celebration. We had alumni come. We had 210 people in this celebration, and we sort of reminisced because it was Dr. Frank Bueller in 1876, and in keeping with the McGill tradition, he had actually toured the world of the time. You know, he had been exposed to people like Bauman, von Helmholtz. He worked with Hutchinson, with Marcus Gunn, and then came back and brought all of that. And it was William Osler who actually had nudged him into going into ophthalmology. And so he set up the first department in, according to the history books, according to some of the research that we did, the first department of ophthalmology in English-speaking North America. And so he basically started that tradition of training, of provision of service, and also research as well back then.
Wow, that's fantastic. And now the torch has been passed to you to take it to the next level even.
Yeah, well, it's, you know, we really, as we we're sort of reminiscing and reviewing the history and everything. A lot has happened here in Montreal in terms of the provision of service. We have different hospitals, the Jewish General Hospital, Montreal General Hospital, Royal Victoria, the Children's Hospital, and then also other community hospital or smaller hospitals that contribute overall to the training of our residents. Then we have incredible people as well doing research in different areas. Genetics, we're working on genetic therapy for retinal diseases, neurology and neuro-ophthalmological conditions as well. Immunology was one of the things that attracted me here back then. And now we're working quite a bit on simulation research as well.
Right. Yeah, you have the ocular simulation lab. I know you're doing a lot with AI projects now. The Maestro software you have for laser vision correction. There's a lot of stuff going on.
There's a lot of stuff. There's lots of stuff going on. And you know, that's I think that's one of the things that happens is when you enter, you know, if we look at, and maybe I'm talking now to the younger generations, sure. You know, if we're really kind of targeted into, you know, this is what I want. I want to work here and do these number of cases per day and then go home. Then that's good. It's good. It's a good provision of service you're providing. You're doing good work, right? But I think the moment you start opening some doors and exploring other things, all of a sudden you begin to realize that there's very interesting individuals doing very interesting things, which really, after a few years of doing the same thing, it's kind of good to reinvent yourself and start exploring other things that maybe you would not have considered. And for me, that has been a discovery. You know, I never thought I would be involved in AI projects or, for example, robotics. We work closely with our robotics lab as well. We're developing materials. We're developing different devices as well. And those are things that, you know, sounded interesting, but I never thought that I would be directly involved with many of these projects with so many different and smart individuals who come up with these ideas.
Well, that's one of the nice things being the chair. You get to oversee like so many different things that are even outside your comfort zone, things that are new to you. So what's kind of like your blueprint for the next 5, 10, 15 years in your department? And how do you kind of organize all that, that leadership? What are the challenges of being a leader?
Mm-hmm. So I think there's different aspects to that. And one of the things that I think is important, first of all, is to kind of understand the culture of the department. Yeah. And before moving here to McGill, I had explored different departments. I had explored other opportunities. And when I came to McGill, maybe because this is where I trained, I knew many of the people, right. Many of the residents that I trained with are now my colleagues. Some of my mentors are good friends now, and that, you know, when you identify what is important in a department. I remember when I came here for the interviews, they asked me, well, what do you think is the strongest point about McGill? And it just came into my mind. I said, the people. It's the people is the biggest asset, because I think there's a will. You know, there's challenges in a province like Quebec, economic challenges, and there's a lot of limitations or constraints in different ways. But when I saw the people and I saw that they did want to change, that was the big driving force for me to come here. And so one of the first things that I did was present a vision of where I wanted to go. But immediately after, we did a strategic planning retreat and we defined a few things. So all of our projects are basically driven by partnership and innovation. I think, you know, innovation is a nice word, it's a nice buzzword, but I really think that by doing the second part, which is the pillars that we established, we have been able to obtain certain things by partnering with the individuals or organizations and by innovating. So our pillars are really partnerships, one of them. There's scholarship. There's also patient service, provision of services. And all of these things come together, really, to sort of drive and set up a compass for us to sort of know where we're going. And so we started with reorganizing a little bit of the governance. We started organizing the residency committee, targeting some of the newer developments from the Royal College, like competency by design and competency-based education. We also, I thought we needed something strategic to distinguish us. And so we worked really hard in establishing the simulation lab. Right. We started hiring people, younger generations as well, and a newer equipment as well. So we got equipment for clinics and we got even a femtosecond laser for one of the public hospitals. And that will allow us to sort of set the stage for corneal surgery at a different level. This year, we're planning and we just hired an associate chair for research. And so this individual is going to restructure everything so that we don't have independent silos, but rather more communication. And so the plan is to sort of to improve on the organization of governance, improve on the organization of the research aspects. And also, we created a series of task forces to kind of bring the culture together. So we have a social media task force. We have a quality improvement task force. And all of these also kind of are sort of food for our program to sort of enhance different aspects and improve the culture in our program.
So when you were hiring the new faculty, what do you look for to recruit the faculty you want? And then what are the other secrets to like retention of the faculty you do have?
Yeah. Well, I have to say that has been, in a way, a challenge, and in a way, not a challenge. In a way, not a challenge because we have found really amazing and dedicated individuals. Right. The fact that people want to live in Montreal and people want to work and also be a part of McGill has been a plus. And I think that has motivated people to join either as associates or as full-time staff and contribute in ways that I also did not imagine. You know, we have people doing a lot of wellness work. We have a lot of individuals that have taken the reins in terms of running with the simulation program. Sure. But conversely, it is hard because the province of Quebec has limitations. You mentioned originally at the beginning of the podcast, the French aspect. So if someone is not comfortable or does not want you, you actually have like 4 years to pass the French exam. Oh. And if you don't pass it, then you cannot work here. There's different professions that have those limitations. In addition, we've had some challenges as well with some laws that attempted to sort of to change the way we deliver care in the province. And so us as physicians in our federations, we had to work really hard to try to minimize or mitigate those changes. And so predicting what's going to happen in 5 or 10 years has actually forced a few physicians, including my family physician, to leave the province. We've had in different areas of McGill, people going to the States, going to other provinces. And so that's a bit disappointing because we train good people, we think we're going to be able to bring them back, and then we're blindsided by this law or that law, and that scares people away. I think if you're starting your practice, you have a young family, it's really unfair to expect that someone will be able to weather all those unpredictable issues over the years. Whereas if we have people who are later in their careers or more established or have great family ties or social ties to the province, then they stay. So unfortunately, I always look for the best individuals, and I think we've gotten some amazing individuals.
Sure.
At the same time, we've been strapped as well or limited in terms of recruiting for other specialties when people express interest, but then they're disappointed by the fact that they really would not be able to come here.
Yeah, there's certainly challenges, but maybe you'll get lucky. Like you trained in McGill, went to Manitoba for 20-something years, and you came back.
Yeah, I came back. And I think there's a lot of things because, they often think, one of the things that I often relate to in terms of what I'm trying to do with the department is a book that I read called The Medici Effect. And it talks about how the Medici family back in the Renaissance era, they brought a lot of people, different cultures, different disciplines to Florence. And so that's where the interaction between accountants and businessmen, between artists and mathematicians, all of a sudden that started generating the Renaissance, right? And so you sometimes need a little bit of tension, you need a little bit of instability to kind of bring about ideas and bring about change. And somehow that's what happens here in Montreal. That's what I have seen also at McGill, with people coming together. When we see in one room a biomedical engineer, someone who knows computers, and a physician or a med student, boom, all of a sudden an idea is generated. And the fact that people like living here, it's a beautiful city, very easy to get around, I think just generates great ideas, great concepts, and great kind of innovative ideas of managing patients, treating patients, and finding a way to provide top of the line services despite some of the limitations we may have. So I think it's better than if you have everything just given and stable and everything, it's good. But it's like being on cruise control. And sometimes you need a little bit of the excitement, without getting too far off the road, but you need a bit of excitement.
No, I think you absolutely do. And they bring together the different disciplines, I think, together. Mm-hmm. It's really, like you said, that's where great ideas kind of sprout. Mm-hmm. So your residency program, and it was very popular, very highly ranked. Mm-hmm. It's long, 5 years compared to most U.S. residents, there are only four.
Correct.
But they have a great hands-on surgical experience. But how are you incorporating some of these new ideas into the curriculum for the next generation of ophthalmology residents?
Mm-hmm. Yes, so a few things, general things in Canada are basically the competency-based education. So we're all kind of learning how to target different specific tasks or skills, and we as faculty have to sort of provide feedback in a more direct and more constant way. So that's something that has been changing. We have now cohorts that are past the middle of the years that we have in training, that are becoming assessed, I guess, and trained in this way. So we'll see where that takes us. There are some benefits to that, being able to specifically determine if a resident can complete a task independently and successfully. And so we're learning from that. The other aspect is our ophthalmology simulation laboratory. Nice. So we were able, and once again, this is kind of partnership and innovation. We were able to find funds, some special funds from contracts that were available, a lot of funds as well from foundations, from very, very generous donors. And we established a completely sustainable program. And sustainable, I mean that we just didn't buy the toys, so to speak, and then let them sit okay. there. But we have funds that allow us to renew licenses and get other equipment and basically establish a fully fledged program. And so we formed a committee, the simulation committee, and we have a unique program in Canada where we actually have diagnostic training, surgical training, and we have a curriculum that takes in a graded fashion medical students, but also first year, second year, third year residents through different aspects. And we evaluate that, we can see, we can monitor who is doing what, how many hours they're participating. And that has been very unique. And now there's talk at the COS level that perhaps other programs would want to work together. And as I was waiting for this call, I got another email from another chair saying that we should move this forward so that we have a national simulation curriculum. So that's how we've been doing that in terms of the simulation. So we have workstations for dry labs. We have virtual stations as well. And we have individual as well events. For example, we had a whole afternoon on MIGS. And it was all MIGS for our residents. And we had all the glaucoma staff come. We also have events for industry. So industry may want to display their lenses, their machines. We have each of the machines here in our lab. And so with that, we're able to expose our residents to all of these aspects. And then we've added the research component. And what that has done is has allowed the residents to go beyond the usual tasks, but start to think about new approaches, new devices. We're looking at education programs and education research projects. So does it really improve? You know, does it really improve to have simulation down the line, or do you, or can you just do it, you know, with human training and by apprenticeship? And so we're looking at that as well objectively. And then that has attracted other individuals. So we have right now around 20 projects being coordinated by our biomedical engineer, a PhD in biomedical engineer. And we have medical students, we have engineering students, we have computer students, and they're all working together in different different aspects of ophthalmology, all our eye-related projects. And so I think that creating a bit of a hub for the residents and students and medical students and other disciplines has really raised the level of our program. And I hope that all of this translates at the level of our residents into improved patient care, improved, because that's the goal, obviously, right? In the end, what we want is to have improved patient care and improved results for them.
I think it definitely will. UCLA, for gosh, more than 10 years, we were using the surgical simulators as well. Mm-hmm. Published a paper showing that actually it did make a significant difference. Mm-hmm. But you're right. In the U.S. as a whole, I don't think there's a unified for every program. Here's the curriculum we're all going to agree to.
Exactly.
It kind of does it differently. But we did show it made a difference. And look, even like pilots, 100% of pilots have to do the simulators, not that's just right. The actual planes. You got to do both.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And I think even just the setup of, you know, just knowing the pedals, knowing how to adjust everything, that you're already a step ahead. And right. And I think one of the challenges in homogenizing a curriculum is, first of all, different places, different facilities will have different funding levels, right? And so they may not be able to acquire all of the equipment, all of the devices that are needed. And so you have to adapt that curriculum. But I think it would be important to sort of, you know, we do log all the devices that we use. You're able to log hours and have a personalized account. And then we, as administrators, we can check exactly who's been on the simulator longer or this or that, or, you know, how are they doing? So that makes them accountable as well for learning. You know, I remember in our days, probably Uday, we spent hours just suturing, right?
Because yes.
That was the thing. And I always said, you know, we're losing the suturing aspect, whereas we shouldn't. It's almost like a musician practicing scales. Yeah, maybe it's boring, but, you know, if you practice scales, you're really practicing on and on and on the basic skills to perform or to play your instrument. And so I think pushing that mindset into our residents of being ready and being trained and putting in the time for surgical simulation will be important.
Yeah, I totally agree. The suturing part, it teaches you how to use your hands under a microscope, and no one's born knowing how to do it. Mm-hmm. So even just go to the wet lab, you can get a tomato, get a grape, cut it. And the goal is, can you do 10 sutures of 10 on nylon in 10 minutes in the wet lab?
Yeah.
And absolutely. If you can do that, you know how to use your hands under the microscope.
Exactly.
But yeah. I think we, you know, I always emphasize both. I want you to practice suturing in the wet lab, but also, yes, do these surgical simulators. And now there are multiple companies that make these. Before it was just the IC.
Exactly.
Now we've got helpmesee.org. That's yes. made by the company or sponsored by a billionaire who made his money making flight simulators.
Correct. Yes. That's right. And that is actually a very good simulator. I would say we had a little bit of difficulty getting it to here, to our university. I did look at it for quite some time. And I knew and I know some of the people that are involved in the medical advisory level there. And it is great because, you know, it combines both the virtual aspect, but also the tactile aspect, the haptic feedback. So you get haptic feedback with only haptic feedback and some visual feedback with the Fidelis, where the Alcon, you get mostly visual feedback, but not really tactile with the IC simulator. So it's good. It's different tasks and different things. But with the Help Me See, you get both. And so that's, I think, very interesting. So I'm still eyeing it for our department. But, you know, the business model has not kind of fit with our plans at this point.
Yeah, no, I think it was... get any of them. As long as you have one of them, I think you're going to be fine. Okay. Be great. Yeah,
that's right. And now we're also working because, you know, we get a lot of, we have tried every single artificial eye, the Simuli, the Bionicle, the Philips eye. And so the interesting part is it's also like there's no perfect eye. Some are great for the cornea. Some are great for coming in. Some are great for nucleus. Some for capsulorhexis. So we're also experimenting. You know, one of the papers that we produced in our facility, believe it or not, it's using lentils. And depending on the preparation of the lentil, I went in and I cracked it like it was a regular cataract, honestly. And so, you know, we're coming up with these ideas and it's students really that are bringing these ideas and trying different things for capsulorhexis. And so at some point we hope to have something that is integrates all the different aspects in which is the best model or the best model or technique for a particular task, you know?
Yeah, no, I think they're all very reasonable. Even we used to microwave the pig eyes for 10 seconds to harden the nucleus.
That's right.
I'll tell you, I just did a lot of practicing on pig eyes and also actual very expensive human cadaver eyes before I did the robotic trial last year in El Salvador. Wow. And so I did many fresh 24 hours old cadaver eyes. They are nothing like real eyes.
No.
Like living eyes. The 24 hours makes a humongous difference. The lack of blood flow makes a humongous difference.
Yeah. That's amazing. It's amazing. And so I guess one of the other things we're working on, and you and I had talked a little bit about that, was the incorporation of AI basically
sure.
in the analysis of these videos. And I'm not sure, I'd also love to hear what you've done with the robotics aspect of it. But what we've been doing is taking virtual or artificial eyes, and now we're starting to feed the system with just regular live surgery as well, or regular surgery, and sort of providing segmentation and phase segmentation of all the different steps. And to the point that we're hoping that we would be able to coach or supervise someone who can just put in their video and have it analyzed via AI and provide metrics as to how they're doing, how they're training, so that you don't necessarily have to have someone with you all the time. You can do that video review, but in a more objective way as well. And I would imagine that would fit very nicely with anything in terms of robotics.
Oh, for sure. Absolutely. But I mean, at this point, God, the AI is a little still too early in the curve. So for reference, like all my cataract coach videos, and now by the time this airs, we'll have 3,000 videos.
Yeah.
It's a huge library. Yeah. They're all on YouTube, and YouTube is Google. And so Google Gemini now can get transcripts from all my videos and use that as the data source and help me write things now.
Yeah.
And usually pretty good, but it's still not, I'd say it's not even 90% good yet.
Okay.
It's going to take a little bit of time there. So I have a lot of interest in these projects too with AI as well. And we'll get there for sure, but it's not going to be as overnight as we thought.
Yeah. That's right. That's right. And then there's the aspect.
Other AI projects, right? I'm sorry to interrupt you. You have other AI projects. I was reading you have like AI-driven quantification of uveitis levels.
Yeah.
You've got... You got so many projects. I was looking, I couldn't believe how many.
Yes, we have quite a few projects. And so one that happened precisely from that aspect of partnership, I guess, is we had an ophthalmology resident from Italy here through some sort of mutual contacts and working with the university in Brescia. And so basically he came here and spent 6 months observing in clinic and surgery, but also working on a number of projects. And one of the things they had done and had published with Vito Romano, and then his name is Giacomo Beschi, they looked at OCTs of eyes immediately after DMEC, and they wanted to quantify the inflammation. So they did a hand count of cells, basically. So when they got here, so Giacomo was here, and basically we connected with one of the students, and she basically said, well, I think I can do a program about this. And so basically we have an AI program now that automatically counts the cells. And then the idea is then to correlate that and know exactly what the flow or what the images are, how they correlate with the levels of inflammation. Then eventually, I mean, could we detect early rejection? Uveitis and doing something like that. There's other projects that other residents, and I've just sort of tagged along in some of these projects because some of these projects relate to machine learning and diagnosis of glaucoma. And I kind of got dragged into it because they found that some of the important aspects related to corneal thickness, not in the way that we knew, the 545, you know, if it's thinner, all that, but as a predictive value for other aspects of glaucoma and glaucomatous damage. So now they're moving into that, and I'm sort of the cornea consultant, so to speak. And so we're doing that. Other things we've started working on is the triaging for ophthalmology, for emergencies. And so we had one resident and an external colleague as well who was working on that. There's so much potential on that and minimizing the time that a patient can spend on the phone trying to get through. So we're working on that as well. And then definitely we deal a lot with the northern populations. We have Inuit populations, and we have a program that looks into that. But being able to set up, we have another colleague in the province who has developed this amazing system with basically two different iPhones, but you can look at it on an iPad that gives you the 3D image without it being 3D. You don't need 3D glasses. And so you can assess patients, but you can also feed that into AI programs to diagnose diabetic retinopathy and other conditions. So we're also, that's another one of our other objectives for the next few years as well, being able to really establish that to service the northern populations.
Yeah, if you think about it, you could have like various tests already done without having an ophthalmologist there, and then the data you get would be enough.
Exactly. Right now, to put it in perspective, it costs around $9,000 just to bring an individual down here for an assessment. So imagine if you cut that, you're saving money, but you're also decreasing or increasing, I guess, the quality of life for someone who has to get on a plane, come down here, be assessed. Oh, it's okay. It's nothing. Then head back, you know. So we're maximizing the funds and the resources we have. We're doing it in a digital kind of way and a modern kind of way, but we're also enhancing the population's quality of life with unnecessary trips.
Right. I mean, if you had like anterior segment and posterior segment photos, mm-hmm. anterior and posterior segment OCTs, I mean, I'm kind of pretty good right there. We were diagnosed 98% of things.
That's pretty much all you need. And then, you know, if you have a good camera that can record and you have you can virtually program cameras to, you know, cut a slit and detect certain things, or you train a technician to do the 5 steps or 6 steps to give you a good assessment, you can see the patient remotely, right? In a synchronous or an asynchronous way. And you just pick a day where you're just boom, 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 assessing, send them down. No, no need to send down.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't realize it was that expensive to send someone, right?
Yeah. Yeah, for us here it is. Yeah, it's very
very far distance, right?
Yeah,
very far north.
I believe that somebody told me that the distance to fly from Montreal to one of the northern communities is the same as flying from Montreal to Nashville. in the States. So it's pretty far.
Yeah, you sometimes forget how big it is.
Exactly. We forget how big it is.
Very interesting. Let's talk a little bit about your surgical techniques. You've got some really neat ideas.
Oh, good.
About your corneal surgeries, the way you're combining like cross-linking with the femto, cutting with the laser. And this is just tell me more about this. It's so fascinating.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, surgery is my passion, as I'm sure it is yours. I know I've known you for many years, and so I know it is yours as well. And, you know, with me, it has evolved in a concept that my fellowship mentor, Jim Rousey, he always used to talk about designer surgery. And so with that, you know, the concept has evolved. I remember when I finished my residency in 1995, I was talking to one of my mentors, and he said to me, you know, nothing has really changed in corneal surgery in almost 100 years, because, you know, the first transplant was in, 1905 with Zerm. And really, if it's an anterior stromal or posterior disease, take the whole cornea and just replace it, right? So my goal over the past few years has been to really kind of make it a layer-by-layer approach. I often joke that in Canada, we need to dress in layers to withstand the cold and then kind of go back out or whatever. And so thinking of the cornea in layers is a good way to really target the disease. So in the case of keratoconus, over the years, you know, I got involved with Intax back in 1999 just for low myopia. And then in 2005, 2006, I started working on it for keratoconus. A few colleagues had, you know, I took a couple of courses. And at first, to be honest with you, I questioned it. I wasn't sure it would work because originally we were using it to correct low myopia with no astigmatism. You know, that was the intent of intracorneal ring segments. Yeah. And so they're asking them now to correct high myopia with very distorted astigmatism. So it took me a while, but I was one of the first ones in Canada to implant them. And I started seeing some good results. Then in 2010, I started with cross-linking. And it was in a young guy who had a transplant in one eye and was developing decreasing vision in the other with keratoconus. And he was the perfect candidate because even after 25 years when I left, or 20 years when I left Brandon, he was still stable. And so I started doing that. And then, you know, you start kind of thinking, well, this guy has a bit of astigmatism. Should I add a bit of correction? And so I started combining treatments to the point that the way I kind of think about it now is, if they have a decent cornea thickness around 440, let's say, microns, and not an excessively curved cornea, let's say 55 diopters or less, I think there's a lot we can do without subjecting a patient to a corneal transplant. Sure. For younger individuals, we want to avoid them, right? Because if they get hit or if they're active, they can burst. And I had two cases, bilateral, two individuals who went blind from freak accidents because of a ruptured corneal grafts, both eyes. It was horrible. And you know, so my motivation has been to avoid corneal transplants in keratoconus. So if they have decent visual acuity and not an excessive correction, then I use topography-guided laser combined with cross-linking. If they have less vision, corrected vision, so for example 20/50, 20/60, then I know they're going to have a significant change of the cornea, and in that case I want to change the cornea more dramatically, for example with intracorneal ring segments and also combined with cross-linking. Oftentimes they might have an excessive correction and high cylinder, but they have good corrected vision. In those cases, all I want to do is stabilize them with cross-linking. And then I put a fake IOL to correct them. And so that's sort of how my approach has evolved. I always want to see what the goal of the patient is, what we need to do. And the three questions I ask are, do I need to stop progression? That gears me towards cross-linking. Second, do I need to change the corneal shape dramatically because they can't reach a good corrected vision? In that case, I need to combine it with something else. And the third point is, do I need to improve the quality of vision? And so that's where I really consider targeting aberrations and targeting other aspects of their visual function that will allow them to improve. And so with that, you know, we have all of that said for keratoconus. But now the exciting things is we're getting more and more into using the femtosecond laser, which I think it's almost like a Swiss Army knife.
Oh, yeah.
That allows us to play with different things. And so we've started using Susan Jacobs' technique of CARES.
Right.
Corneal allogenic intracorneal segments. And that really targets patients who don't have a good best corrected vision, who have high coma, so therefore poor quality of vision, and who require an improvement in their shape and their quality of vision. And so I had done before moving here a few cases, but now we're customizing them thanks to the femto. So I'm cutting them depending on the prescription that I need.
Well, amazing part is you're able to get a femtosecond laser for your government hospital, your teaching hospital, which is something that's very difficult to do.
It is. And once again, you know, it's that partnership and innovation. So I think intrinsically, many of the individuals who work in any healthcare system really want to improve things. And so sometimes we're kind of constrained by red tape or by bureaucracy. But if you find the right individuals, then a lot can be done. And so here I was able to kind of demonstrate the credibility of having a laser. We were able to demonstrate that we had the money for it. There were some special funds, but also we got some generous donors to help us with that. And then you kind of have to build a business plan and start working and sort of making sure that everybody is involved. So once the people at the hospital, the nursing team, they believed in the fact that we could do something unique, then once you have that buy-in, then it's just a matter of going through the paperwork and going through all of that. And so it took us a while. I'm not saying it was an easy task, but we're all very excited with our femtosecond laser and looking forward to, first of all, providing patient care in a more targeted, more customized way, but also the research opportunities and making our program unique for people who want to train in cornea. They'll be more attracted, hopefully, to our program because they'll be using a technology that perhaps it's not available everywhere else.
Yeah, I think that's a great thing. If you're doing your training, if you're young, to get that hands-on experience during your training is
exactly. Really
great. I saw some other work you're doing about increasing, supercharging graft adhesion. So you have some data showing that UV cross-link lamellar and penetrating grafts have better tensile strength. Tell me about this.
Well, okay, that I cannot say I have clinical experience with that.
Yeah.
I know we published that paper many, many years ago as part of our experimental sort of exploration, I would say, of cross-linking. So at the time, cross-linking, when we published that paper, cross-linking was just starting, and I wanted to understand it better. So, you know, interestingly, I found an optics professor, and he basically built me a cross-linking machine with the proper nanometers and everything, proper wavelength, for less than $300. Don't tell that to anybody because, you know, it is just light after all, right? So we experimented on different things, and then we applied tension to see if we could sort of separate or if there was any adhesions of lamellar grafts on that. And we demonstrated that in only one paper with very few eyes. And it was published, but I think I ran into a colleague of mine from Latin America who said, hey, I tried that and I've been doing that, but I have never done it clinically. And I think it's just a way of exploring things and exploring different aspects.
Yeah, the mind's always going. You're always thinking, now that I have these new, what can I do next? What's the next one? I love that.
So in fact, you know what, today, one of the things that really kind of shifted my mind, because as I was going through medical school, I was not exposed to research as much, but I joined a surgical training facility in my last year, the social service year in Mexico, and I had a really great mentor, Dr. Padilla. And so he basically was developing, he was a general surgeon, vascular surgeon, and he was preparing grafts with glutaraldehyde. And what glutaraldehyde basically does is cross-links. It cross-links tissue. And so he tried them, and I was working with him on that, and we were doing grafts in rats as well at the time, so vascular surgery in rats. And one day he said, well, you're interested in ophthalmology. What happens if you do glutaraldehyde to the cornea? And I said, it wouldn't work, he said to me. He looked at me and he said, have you tried it? I said, no. Why don't you try it? And so that was, to me, the shift between, you know, just sort of going for the ride as opposed to asking questions, which is the basis of research. So I did try it. I did implant it in animals and it didn't work. But I always say that, you know, interestingly, I was in medical school when I was already cross-linking corneas. Right. So the idea, I think, was right from his point of view, right? But it was not the right either concentration or things or whatever. But glutaraldehyde can be very toxic. But it was that idea of strengthening tissue in some way and making it inert and able to use it by avoiding rejection. And so it was just an interesting story from my past.
Yeah, no, I think that's one of the most important things, especially for a young surgeon, always asking, what can we do differently? What can we do better? Mm-hmm. So obviously, learn what your professor is teaching you, mm-hmm. but then take to the next step and say, question like, okay, well, why are we doing it this way? What about doing it a little bit different way? Mm-hmm. You got to keep pushing the envelope.
Yeah. And I think today, you know, when you've mentioned, I was for 25 years in Manitoba, I did not have access to all of these aspects of robotics and AI and all of these very advanced research techniques and research protocols. But what I did have was a population of patients. And I was working in an area and someone mentioned to me, you know what, you can do a lot of studies here because all of the patients will keep coming to see you because there were not that many ophthalmologists. Yeah. So you've almost got a captive population. And I was asking myself questions as well. So a lot of the research that I did at that time was also with very keen medical students. And it was just answering clinical questions. You know, does this work? Some of the things you mentioned about combining, you know, topography guided laser with cross-linking.
Sure.
It was my own patients. I did every single refraction before and after. So I knew they're not major, huge number of eyes, but I know the data was good because it was just trying to answer a question. Does this work for my patients? And so therefore you say, yeah, I'll keep doing this, or no, I should change something and do something that will improve their vision in a different way, right?
Well, nice part there in Brandon too, in Manitoba, is that for sure you're going to get all the follow-up visits.
Exactly.
In a big city, yeah. You do some surgery, they'd be lost to follow-up and I don't have the post-op data I want.
Yeah, exactly. Yes. And that was a benefit for that and sort of improving my interest in research. You know, I've had to learn a lot. I think that that research is not necessarily my strongest area, but I do like to ask questions and to facilitate those interactions with people who know a lot more about research than me.
Yeah, no, for sure. I think we all have a little bit different skill sets. I do not belong in a lab doing like running DNA gels. I'm not the guy. Mm-hmm. I kind of know my limitations here. Whereas mm-hmm. like you, I love the surgery part. I love asking a lot of questions. I'm mm-hmm. super curious. Sometimes I think I'm too curious because I'm actually not that smart. I'm just trying to figure out what's going on. But yeah, I think that's just the key to all this is how do you go to the next level? What's coming next?
Exactly.
I also like your way of doing you have a very personalized kind of a designer approach to surgery. Mm-hmm. You know, really like deciding, okay, what exactly do we need here? You never do one size fits all.
No. I try not to. I mean, and if we're talking about the cornea, even though it's just half a millimeter, but it has all the possibilities for us to work in different ways, you really have to kind of sit down and see what is the best approach for this particular patient. And now we have options, you know, when we talk about endothelial keratoplasty, we have DMEC, we have DSEC, we have different ways of doing DSEC, and we have fairly complex cases here as well at McGill as a tertiary and quaternary care center. We sometimes get some challenging cases. So in a way, what I was doing in the past in my previous practice was in some ways a little bit more routine than what I'm doing now, where I have to give it a little bit more thought. You know, what am I going to do? Do I do this first? Do I do everything at the same time? And so it has become very interesting for me, also a bit more challenging. But as I said before, you know, sometimes I think it's good to be challenged and to find the best way to help our patients.
Well, sometimes you get very complex patients referred, and like you said, tertiary or quaternary. So these patients they need multiple ophthalmologists. Mm-hmm. They need on the anterior segment, they meet at a posterior segment surgery as well. They actually need to come to a big place like McGill. So you have the whole team.
Exactly. Exactly. That's right. And so that's the other challenge. Sometimes in the public system, it's hard to kind of coordinate all of those aspects, but we somehow seem to manage doing all of that. There's a lot of communication between the surgeons and the colleagues. So somehow it works well.
Yeah, I guess, you know, ophthalmology, we're so ultra specialized. I was having dinner with some physician friends. Yeah. And the general surgeon said, "You all ophthalmologists are all crazy." And I said, "What do you mean?" He says, "This guy here specializes in corneas. You specialize in 500 microns of tissue?"
Yeah.
And he says, "Yeah." But he says, "Yeah, but the retina guy specializes in 300 microns of tissue."
Yeah, exactly.
The general surgeon does lots of surgeries head to toe. He just thought, like, how crazy are you to specialize in microns of tissue?
That's right. That's right.
I said, they're very important, a few hundred microns of tissue, I promise you.
Exactly. That is it. And now, you know, we may see a change as well in that, because we're also taking part in a multi-center study. Right now, it's basically at a history or a progression or progressive history of Fuchs dystrophy. But it is a company that is getting ready to launch genetic therapy. So in the future, we may even just be using drops to correct certain aspects of some of the corneal diseases, right? We're using it more and more, but it will be interesting to see where genetics therapy takes us in the next few years as well.
Yeah, that's a neat idea. Really neat. Obviously, the other side of that too is the other side of the coin is now that people are developing endothelial cells you can just inject inside the AC.
Exactly. And that is also very exciting as well. I had a chance recently to be part of a discussion panel as well in one of the meetings, and it is incredibly interesting. There's cost related issues, but I mean, once you get past the cost and once you get the necessary number of people to use it, you're using one tissue to provide a huge number of potential benefit to our patients.
Right. And there, you know, I travel a lot internationally. There are many countries I go to that don't have an eye bank. They import 100% of the corneas that they use.
Exactly. That's right. That's right.
This would be really a huge improvement. Huge help.
That's right. That's right.
So what are your forward horizons then? So what's kind of coming soon on the horizon for your department? What are your kind of your closing reflections here? We've been talking for almost an hour.
I know, and thank you so much, Uday. This has been excellent and exciting. I think the main goals that I would say for the department in general is the first one is to restructure the research aspect of it. Mm-hmm. I really want to be able if a resident has an idea, if a clinician has an idea. You know, it's very hard for all of us to be comfortable developing protocols, analyzing data, all the research, all the statistics, all of that. It's very difficult. So if we can have a standardized approach or a hub, and that's kind of happening. We are part of the Research Institute of the McGill University Health Center. They have a lot of resources, but one of my first goals would be, how do we integrate research so that it's part of our life? You know, it's part of any patient that comes in, we're collecting data, we're collecting this, we're analyzing. It's easy to do retrospective studies. It's easy to plan prospective studies. And so that would be one of the goals. The second goal I would have is, how do we get to a point where really everybody wants to come and work with us, whether you're a medical student or a resident who wants to do the residency here, a fellow, or you're a clinician and you really want to come and work at McGill? Because that means we've provided all the necessary aspects, the support, the governance around that, and we've provided the international presence that makes people feel interested and curious about McGill Department of Ophthalmology. That would also bring in attraction on the part of industry. So industry can bring interesting projects, pre-market devices or pre-market technologies that we would benefit from, and we would in theory become the leaders if we're involved early enough. So I think that would be my second aspect, making McGill an attractive institution from when it comes to Department of Ophthalmology and Visual Sciences. And then the third is really that culture aspect. I think it's so important for all of us to continue feeling proud about McGill about the things we can do. And it's so exciting because I always link McGill to Montreal. And McGill and Montreal, to me, they go hand in hand. And I think we're very fortunate to be able to live here. On a personal level, I think my next challenge is really becoming an expert in femtosecond laser for corneal transplants. Right. That would be my goal. How do I even customize it even more? You know, how do I really provide designer surgery for our patients, whether it's with femto or with excimer laser surgery? And so that, I think, on a personal level, just pursue the maximum I can get to in terms of corneal surgery.
Yeah, no, for sure. I think, like you, I always love new things. I want to keep learning. Mm-hmm. It's just something exciting. It's something that brings you true happiness to learn, to learn something new. Yeah. So I'm glad you got your new toy, your new femto, and I'm sure you're going to do amazing things. And I'm sure you'll push the envelope to see how far can you really go with this.
Yeah, I hope so. And you know, just talking to you this past hour is kind of getting me all riled up because I just came back from holidays. I was relaxing, but now I'm all excited to get back into it.
So. Yeah, pedal to the metal. You got to do it. I want to thank you so much, Guillermo, for taking the time. It's been a pleasure to learn from you in the last hour.
Thank you, Dave. Thank you so much. It's great to see you again. And thank you so much for you taking the time to sort of find out about our program and what we're doing.
You're doing amazing things. So I want to remind our listeners and viewers, remember, we've got a new Catacode podcast every Sunday on Apple, Amazon, Spotify, Google. Wherever you find a podcast, of course, you find the Catacode podcast. We also have a new Catacode video every single day, more than 3,000 already. Never missed a day in more than 8 years. And we have our sister channel now, RetinaRounds.com, which has incredible retina videos, as well as the Retina Rounds podcast. So until next time, I'll catch you later.